From the home of the Codebreakers and the birthplace of modern computing, this is the Bletchley Park podcast. Welcome to the April 2014 edition of the Bletchley Park podcast. This month we take you inside the 1940s boutique, a new event which helps you recreate wartime glamour. We hear from the daughter and granddaughters of a woman who may or may not have worked at Bletchley Park, but who, family legend has it, knew her brother had been killed in action when the rest of her family could only be told he was missing. We take a sneak peek inside the soon-to-be-opened code-breaking huts, taken back to their wartime glory as part of the transformation of Bletchley Park. We'll find out just how close we came to losing those wooden huts altogether, and we'll hear from a woman who, 70 years on, says her work in the Y service nearly drove her mad. But first, volunteer actors from the local community will help bring code-breaking huts 3 and 6 to life through their projected images and voices. The diverse group were delighted to become part of Bletchley Park's history. They were filmed inside the historic huts themselves by Elbow Productions, the specialist company creating the digital interpretation as part of the £8 million Heritage Lottery-funded restoration of Bletchley Park. I sneaked in to talk to a few of them. I'm in Hut 8, which is currently closed and being put to great use, preparing people to look World War II ready. I'm sitting next to a chap who's having his roots done, I think it's fair to say. Do you want to tell me your name?
My name's Davin Eady. I saw it advertised in The Citizen, I think, and I've done some sort of acting before, something that I'm passionate about, but also being in Bletchley and being back in Milton Keynes, I wanted to be a part of that, so I was really excited when I saw it.
And actually, I was wrong. You're not getting a dye job, are you? That's Brill Cream.
No. Yeah, Brill Cream for the coif, it looks like.
Can you describe what you're doing to
I'm currently transforming his short back and sides into a short back and sides with a bit of a slight curl to it. Because Davin is playing an American citizen, we have to make him look dramatically different from everybody else. So everything that he is more sharp, he's more current. His costume is something which would happen in America, but not in Britain. So he has a double-breasted jacket, he's got the wider lapels, he's got wider trousers, he has turn-ups. All these things in wartime cease to exist, basically, in British men's clothing. They would normally have single-breasted jackets, less pockets on their waistcoats, their jackets. Their turn-ups would be less. The width of the trousers would decrease. So it would go from, let's say, 64 centimetres to 58. So everything is about saving fabric, so they could use it elsewhere for the military. The fashion, in that sense, became very more utilitarian and very more military. The women, again, quite wide shoulders, nipped in waist, very much more simple. And that's how fashion basically was dictated. So I'm just making David look very different from everyone else. So everything he has is expensive. The way he's dressed is more sharply. He stands up more dramatically. I'm trying to just make him look like a massively different person.
Basically, he's a lot shinier and spiffier than everybody else.
Exactly. He's much more sharper. We need the viewer to look at him and actually see the difference between him. And the way he is naturally as a person, and the way his face is, it has more of that sort of classic American face, where his tie would be bigger, the knot would be thicker. So it's all about the sort of personality details, creating him into a not just a different character, but a different nationality.
And so it's all in the visual clues, and that's really interesting to hear that kind of detail, because we read a lot about where veterans talk about when Americans first came, they'd never seen Americans in person before. They were, you know, they'd only seen them in the film, so you'd have been like something stepping out of the silver screen for
exactly.
them.
And that's what I'm trying to create, is trying to create this person who, from his costume, from his hair, just from his face, he's slightly suntanned, that he has a bit more of a fresh sort of youthful, in a way more moneyed look. And so he's coming over as a civilian, American civilian, who is doing something within the park.
So Davin, when you heard you were going to be, you know, the glamorous one out of the bunch, what did you make of that?
Yeah, it's great. I'm quite lucky on this project to play two different characters, so I get to be a soldier as well. So yeah, being the American citizen and having a different look is quite exciting.
I may be getting you completely wrong, never having met you before, but I'm imagining you don't normally sit up that ramrod straight. And is that double-breasted waistcoat?
Yeah, it's the costume. It will do it every time. It's the, yeah, you're tucked into this with the braces, which take, it must have taken ages to get ready. And I've had help today, but waistcoat does definitely help to get you sitting up straight.
Are you still having a crack at acting as a career?
I do sort of bits and pieces. I've got a few things coming up. I've tried a bit of stand-up comedy just to keep my hand in, but yeah, the toils of life have crept in. I need to
reality bites.
Yeah, so it's sort of coming back to earn a bit of money and just do it as more of a hobby or whenever I can, really.
And how do you feel about the fact that you're going to be here quite long term, and you know your face as you are now?
That's really exciting. I think that's amazing. I can't wait to actually see the installment and come around and have a look. That's probably the most exciting part. Once it's all edited together, you're seeing with the narration over the top, I think it's going to be amazing.
A young chap is being aged up, from what I can tell you. Getting some grey stuff put in your hair. And I imagine you don't wear a pinstripe suit like that normally.
No, not normally, no. It's quite nice to dress up like this. I would if I could.
What's your name?
James Beston. I'm a member of the Arts Gateway, so I heard about it through them. They did a call out, and I thought about it more for my wife because she's got a drama background. So I said, oh, should we just go along and see what happens? But I have acted before, and so we just came along. We've been to Bletchley a couple of times, so it was nice. And I mean, we always talk about how nicely dressed everyone was in the 30s and 40s. I'm a big fan of the 30s in particular, so it just all seemed to fit in.
Was she cast as well?
She wasn't, no, unfortunately.
Oh, dear.
But no, that was okay. Yeah. When she came along, it wasn't really the kind of thing she likes to get involved with. So she's looking after the children.
So who are you playing?
I'm playing the intercept controller. So I'm in the hut, and I'm basically on the telephone controlling as the intercepts come in, making sure everyone knows what's happening. And, so that's my task.
Has it given you a bit of an insight into the sort of inner workings, how it was done, being someone who's come a couple of times? And
yeah, it has. It has. I mean, what's really nice is to see Bletchley coming alive, because the last time I was here, we were looking round the huts. The huts, you could just sort of look in, but you could see it was at a point there where it was still very much at the beginnings. You had little signs saying what happened where. And so it's nice now to get more flesh on the bones, as it were, and to see exactly what happened. And so, yes, doing the role play that we did for the auditions and the parts we're playing now, you get more of an understanding of what happens.
Hello, I'm Helen.
And I'm Paul.
And we're married. And we're volunteering as actors at Bletchley Park and have been for a couple of days this weekend. Why did you decide to do this?
I think it's fun. You know, I like dressing up. I like putting on costumes and fancy dress and stuff. And Bletchley Park's only just down the road for us because we live in Bletchley. And the chance to come here and actually put on, you know, authentic 1940s costumes and play act and then be part of Bletchley Park itself for the next, hopefully, 10, 15 years, who wouldn't want to do that? I've played two characters. I was a Royal Naval Commander, and I had to open a letter informing me that Churchill had authorised it for the Americans to come and share code-breaking information. And today I think I'm another Royal Naval Commander. It's a very similar uniform with more badges, and I'm just appearing in backgrounds and stuff. What about you? Who are you playing?
I'm Codebreaker 1, which means that my main scene was of me opening a hatch, pushing through some codes that I'd deciphered, and tapping on a wall two times.
Isn't it cool to think we can bring our daughter here in like 5 or 6 years' time and we can say to her, look, that's daddy, that's mummy pushing stuff through a hatch on that projection.
I know. What's particularly cool for me is the fact that I get to wear a wig, and it's a proper 1940s style wig, and the costumes are amazing. It's just been a really exciting weekend. It's something that we wouldn't normally do, and it's just generally been fun.
And it's sunny.
And
well,
I know, and it's beautiful weather. We're really, really lucky, and it's a really nice team of people, and we get to live in a whole other era.
And
just
also
play act.
Play like we're on telly as well.
Yeah.
Because they've been using proper television equipment. In fact, it's been like a film, and it's been lovely with visitors walking around looking at you, thinking, you know, I mean, you do look a bit like Keira Knightley, Helen, if I can say. And I, in my head, I look a little bit like Roger Moore.
Isn't one of your costumes the same rank as James Bond?
It is, yes, Royal Naval Commander. Yeah. I have been playing Roger Moore, Sean Connery in my head.
That made you very happy,
it did.
Didn't it?
But it's when the visitors come up to you and say, what are you doing here? I quite like that.
Yeah, it is very cool.
And so how did you hear about this first off?
It's quite weird. I came to Bletchley about a year and a half ago just as a visitor. Then, because of the way it worked with the tickets, you could go for a year. I looked for some special events and I went to one which was the 40s weekend in May of last year and got some really good photos. So I went looking at the start of January for when it was on this year and then saw the news article. and thought, well, the worst they can do is say no, and here I am.
And do you act? Is it something you're involved in?
Not directly. I help organise events around London that involve lots of actors, but I don't ever do any myself.
And you fancied trying it before? Is this a real first step for you?
I guess this probably is a first step. Quite like the idea of it, but no, first time.
Okay, so who have you been cast as? You appear to be a civilian.
It's actually my own clothes.
Oh, you are kidding. Well, then you're in the zone. Oh, what a clang, I'm sorry.
No,
you look great. You could step straight onto that set. Well, your hair's very authentic.
I felt like I should get into character on the way.
You've clearly done a good job. Tell me about your character.
So I'm playing a mathematician today, I think that's the one. I'm doing that, and I'm also playing a washkeeper, so I can't remember which way around it is. Basically, it's not going to be an enormous leap for me to play someone who's in their 20s as a mathematician programmer, considering that I am a programmer.
Right.
And I dress like this anyway, so...
It sounds like you're already aware of and quite interested in the history of Bletchley Park and what happened here.
Yeah, I've had quite an interest in it for a couple of years, so it's very important, and it's also still one of those things that not necessarily people know that much about still. It's becoming more well known. People gradually have probably heard of that Alan Turing now, for example, but I don't know, there's still lots of detail of it that no one really knows about.
And how do you feel about being part of the way we're going to tell that story?
Really excited. When I've told people that I was doing it, they've sort of gone, well, that's obvious, isn't it? Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
That's brilliant. And are you going to bring your family to have a look and see if they can spot you?
Yeah, that's the plan. I think there's quite a few of us going to come up around August time or something and have a picnic on the grass and do stuff. So.
Well, superb. Well, we thank you for doing this.
Cool. Well, thank you.
Yeah, if you just roll it. It's a scene where they're sort of on the blackboard trying to work out all these different...
He's been there for a long time.
Yes. So it's a little bit like, panicked, we're trying to get to it, we'll get to it. So yeah, that looks great.
Would that be there? Because that's where my elbow is.
Oh, is that where your elbow? Okay, then put it there, then we'll use it.
Do you want to just bend your arm? Make sure you can...
You're now in costume, you look dramatically different.
Oh, sarcasm.
What a clanger.
There's friends of mine when I said this, it's like, well, so you're just turning up in your clothes then, right? And then,
Well, you've got a tie pin, that's a much fatter tie.
Yeah.
And the tweedy herringbone tank top.
It's sort of a cardigan tank top thing.
Without sleeves. Yeah, you do very much look the part. So tell me what you've been working on today and yesterday.
Well, the last couple of days we've been working on the filming. It's been a long time in the planning. In some of the huts, we're bringing them to life with audio tracks. The audio is there to give a sense of what was going on in the room. But what we see visually are people who are doing something related but not in sync with the audio. It's bringing a sense of life into the spaces. Because so much has been hidden and kept secret, it's very hard for people to imagine people actually being here and actually inhabiting the spaces in a more playful way. They were all young people. They'd have had all the same things going on for themselves at young people do now, so it's quite nice to draw a bit of that out and see them in more human side rather than just the work that they were doing.
Three-dimensional human beings basically rather than just sort of dry records.
Yes, and we've picked up as wherever we can on little stories, things that people did, little strange little quirks and anything that humanises them and brings those elements into it.
And innovation is part of that as well, because we've got some very sort of rudimentary technology that was used to make things easier. We won't give away too much because you'll see it, but it's a really good example of how, you know, when faced with a problem, it doesn't matter if what you come up with is really sort of homely and basic, if it does the job.
Yeah, no, it's absolutely incredible. And as you start to go into the filming, you're trying to motivate the actors and get them to understand what it is they're doing. The sheer tedium of the work that had to go on was just staggering.
Has it been unusual for you working with basically amateur actors? Because we've drawn on local volunteers to get involved in this project, and a lot of them are very excited to be part of how we will tell this story, but they're not professional actors who you're probably used to working with.
We work with a mixture quite often. Personally, I really like the energy that you get from working with people who are from a community and bought into it and doing it for the love of it. It brings a great energy which is quite infectious to everybody working on the project, that these people are coming and giving their time just because they want to. We've done it quite a few times before and found over the years various ways of getting around things that are slightly more tricky. Props handling is very, very difficult for actors, even professional ones, and some of the props here are really quite difficult to operate.
The machines,
and again, without wanting to give it away, but with some of the projections, we're sort of interfacing with the furniture that exists in the spaces, so we're having to use stylized forms of production. It creates quite a lot of challenges for people. I was amazed today at how well a guy managed to catch a tennis ball without even seeming to look at it, just hold his hand out and catch it, which I was actually really dreading as a shot, because I thought we could be there all morning trying to get him to catch the ball. I'll leave you to find out when he catches the ball and why later.
The huts in which those volunteer actors will be seen and heard very nearly blew away altogether. These buildings, about as sturdy as garden sheds, stood for 70 years. If work to restore them had started just a year later, the chances are the storms earlier this year would have reduced them to a pile of rubble. I spoke to Rob Davies, the site manager from Fairhurst Ward Abbots, who's overseen Project Neptune.
Side, this is the weak point of the building.
We're standing outside Hut 3, which is now well secured and got all refreshed and sympathetically restored boards along the side, the roof firmly in place, and a lot of floorboards inside from Fawley Court, and a lot of the original still there. We're at the set dressing stage now, but if we rewind a little, we had some very severe weather a few weeks ago. I'm joined by Rob Davies, site manager, who's looked after the project throughout. Can you tell me what went through your mind when we had that severe weather and what stage we were at then?
Well, even when we arrived, we were amazed that the huts were still standing, and the fact that in some places it seemed to be levitating because all the sole plates had disappeared, rotten away. So considering the amount of weather and like heavy rain we've had and the high winds, I would have thought after that they'd probably have fallen down. So severe weather that we've had, I think the days would have been numbered. So I think we probably got there just in the nick of time.
So literally, if we'd have started a year later, after 70 years, then 1 year, it would have made that difference.
Yeah, exactly. It would have been pretty close, I'd have thought. You know, windy day, the windy days we had, yeah, they could have been on the floor.
Because we lost a bit of a wall and a tree around sort of the out-of-sight bits of the site, didn't we?
Yeah, exactly. We did have some damage at Bletchley. I mean, it wasn't significant, but yeah, I think it could have been a lot more dramatic had the huts not been repaired when they were.
Can you imagine trying to explain to people if there'd just been a pile of rubble? I mean, it so nearly was.
Yeah, it would have been. It would have been heartbreaking for everybody because, you know, we were able to salvage a lot of the original fabric of the building, even now when we got here. So that would have been extremely difficult, you know, picking stuff out of a pile of rubble.
This Easter, the mansion will be brought to life again by actors who'll talk to visitors as though they too were working at the Government Code and Cipher School during World War II. They'll be in place from the 11th to the 21st of April. See our website for details. Some prestigious and exciting speakers are coming up in the Bletchley Park Presents series. The first of these Sunday afternoon talks is at Easter, with author and journalist Christy Campbell, telling the story of how Bletchley Park found out where Germany was developing cutting-edge weapons. In May, we bring you Gordon Welchman's biographer, Joel Greenberg. And in July, we proudly present four women who worked at Bletchley Park and its outstations during World War II. There's much more to come later in the year, too. Watch this space and the Bletchley Park website for details. The first 1940s boutique at Bletchley Park was steeped in wartime glamour. Participants learned from an expert, vintage stylist Sarah Dunn of Sarah's Doo Wop Doos, how to create that iconic 1940s look. The lessons included how to tie their hair into victory rolls, as well as makeup tricks of the era, such as the red lipstick that helped define that decade. I caught up with Sarah and her model for the day, MK News reporter Jessica Duncan.
Don't sit under the apple tree with anyone else but me. Anyone else but me.
So how do you feel it's going so far?
As long as everyone's happy, I'm happy. Yeah.
But I really like what you said. You should feel great. You should feel like you can take on the world.
Yeah.
So do you feel like you can take on the world?
Yes, no, definitely.
Have you ever seen yourself look anything like you do?
I've never seen myself look this glamorous. So I'm absolutely in awe of what she's just done in so little time as well. I think she's incredible. And I think all of these girls are really going to enjoy the transformation that they're all about to go through with her help.
It's right, it is a transformation. I think that's the key word, that we have sleek hair, you know, I was saying earlier about the contouring, and even the 40s makeup is so, so different, and I think people will see themselves completely differently. But hopefully feminine, pretty, but, you know, it's such a great look, and the silhouette's just stunning, so I really want people to feel completely transformed. I love that, yeah. It's an absolute transformation.
And we could easily fall into the trap of thinking that this is all about people as young and fresh as Jess here, but of course it applies to all ages.
The great thing is that it suits all ages, you know, everybody looks good in this look. I mean, again, the look from the 40s was born out of austerity and not having very much, and women were able to do so much with so little. So it's about just trying things out. If you don't like it one way, change it up. The pattern and the setting pattern that I've taught today, people will be able to go home and wear it in a million different ways, and that's the fun of it. You find out what works for you, and I'm on hand to give kind of one-to-one advice about that as well. So what works for one person is not going to work for the person sat next to them, so I'll go in there and kind of make sure that they come away with a look that they're happy with as well, which is nice. It can be very much tailored to each person, so the nice thing is that I've got time now to kind of sit one-to-one with people. You know, people's hair type's different, people wear their makeup differently, people might like certain parts of the look and not the other, so it's about tailoring this to suit you, keeping it authentic and 40s, but also going away with something that you're really happy with that makes you feel good. You should leave here feeling fantastic. Introduce yourself.
Well, I'm Faye McKinney, and this is Leslie Flint, my sister.
And what brought you here today?
Well, it's actually a birthday present to ourselves. I'd done a headscarf day with Sarah, and I'd planned on booking a half day with her for the two of us. And then this came up. I saw this online and thought that'd be a fabulous, nice day out for us both, and actually looking at the makeup side as well.
So you're both interested in 1940s, and you go to some vintage festivals?
The whole style, the music. We run a singing group, and we do quite a bit of 1940s in that as well.
And then, so we've been to events like Twin Woods, and we have an older sister who lives up north, and she's very much into it as well. But we're always on the lookout for sort of more vintage wear and more vintage events around this area as well. And so we've up till now we've been kind of cobbling together, been looking at YouTube really about how to do the hair and how to do the makeup. And obviously Sarah seems to be the leading expert in the Bedfordshire area. So we thought we would come to the horse's mouth and find out exactly how to adapt the 40s style to modern day cuts, because my older sister's got shorter hair. I've got sort of medium length hair with a fringe, and my obviously younger sister's got longer hair with a short fringe. So we wanted to figure out how to incorporate the fringe specifically, and also shorter hair in 1940s styles.
And what is it about the 1940s style that resonates with you?
I think with us, we always like to make an effort. We do like to dress up as well. And that idea of dressing up has gone out in modern times. People don't tend to dress up. They tend to sort of dress down if they're going either for a restaurant or wherever. And so it's nice to be able to actually just make a real effort. And the care of detail, whether it's the hair and it's the makeup,
it flatters women's figures. And Sarah's saying it is the whole silhouette, the way it kind of... of looks.
And it's great for all figures. So if you look at a good 1940s cut, whether it's a pencil skirt and a jacket, that looks fabulous on someone who's size 16, size 18, or someone who's size 10. We've got a lot of Vivian Holloway clothes, which again is 50s and 40s. And in our dance little section of the singing group, we all have Vivian Holloway dresses, and ranging from the size 18 to the size 10, all the women look fabulous in it because of the way it's cut.
We haven't done the hair yet, but how would you rate the day? Do you think it's sort of worth the time and the effort to make your way to come?
It is. Sarah is incredibly knowledgeable and amazing. She never dries up once. She keeps the banter going forever, even when there's quiet bits. And there wasn't many people that had to ask any questions, because she was just a wealth of knowledge of information.
Interesting.
Yeah. Yes.
Yeah, she covered it all, didn't she, in some useful, like, little facts that you would never have known.
Well, it's funny when she was talking about a lip liner, saying that she did it on her hand first to warm it up, and I was thinking, well, I do that, but I never knew why I did it, you know. So there's lots of little tips of just where she applies makeup and just, you know, does the hair, and that it has made the world's difference.
Well, I'd like to say thank you for your time and enjoy the rest of your day.
Thank you very much.
You like my style, why don't you make me know it? You like my walk, you like my talk, but well, there's only one way to show it. If you want to shake my hand, like they do it in Harlem, stick your hand right out and shout, give me some skin. My friend, step right up and take your stand. You don't have to be timid, stick your hand right.
My name is Suzanne Gall. I'm a beauty therapist and tutor at Central Bedfordshire College. I've come to this 1940s boutique with my colleagues as a part of our CPD programme, so that we have to teach our students about different eras of makeup and hairstyles, and so we just thought this was a really good way.
Worse ways of career development.
Yes, this is a wonderful way we get to enjoy ourselves. My colleagues also have been watching the programme on the TV.
The Bletchley Circle. Yes,
that's right. And so it was sort of all linked together. And so we had a look online and then we saw this event was happening. So we all jumped at the chance. We have to show the students that if they're on just a hairdressing course, that there are other progression routes. So if you wanted to go into film and TV, theatre, so there's different areas. And so you'd have to be more authentic in your styles. So we do teach about history.
What have you found about today? Have you come across some interesting facts that you didn't know?
It was just probably, you know, learning about ingredients and things, your beetroot and the starch, and you know that how we'd be horrified about not being able to wash our hair every day. It's just those sorts of things, really, more than anything else. And you know, how you'd gone 3 or 4 days worth of hairstyle, whereas we would just brush it out the next day. You know, one day at the hairdresser and we don't blink an eye, whereas it was a big thing to go to the hairdresser then. So yeah,
yes,
just reinforced about how frugal they had to be, really, I think. Or an instant society, whereas in
absolutely,
those days they
yes,
weren't. So yes, yeah, it's the difference is how, you know, they've had to plan for their hairstyle, whereas you just go home, wash your hair and do it sort of thing for the night out. So that's the difference, I think, really.
We don't wear hats now, and yet it just
no.
looks absolutely
and
wonderful.
Also I've put this hat on and you'd think, oh, it's so tiny it's going to fall off, but actually it feels like really well secured, and you think, you made you wonder how they managed to keep these tiny little things perched on the side of their head, but actually I don't think I'd lose it in a gale.
Sarah did a really good job of illustrating the historical facts around
that's right,
it as
yes.
well, and the austerity on how ingenious women had to be
that's
then.
Right yes.
Well, I hope you enjoy the rest of your day.
Well, we've had a wonderful time so far. Thank you.
Step right
once more,
shake my hand. Like they do it in Harlem today.
How do they do it?
Just stick your hands up, let out with the shout. Give me some skin, my friend. If you want to shake my hand, like they do it.
I often say you never know who you'll bump into at Bletchley Park, and this really is a case in point. At that first 1940s boutique, a woman had been treated to the day by her two daughters, and they had a very personal reason for wanting to visit Bletchley Park.
So tell me about your mother. What did you know about what she'd done?
Well, that she worked in London. She says she worked underground a lot because of the bombing. She was in the ATS. And we believe she was a cipher operator, whether or not she was involved in codes, I have no idea. But she was brilliant at maths, intimidatingly so from my point of view. I don't know what else, really.
And it was just a passing mention, wasn't it, from your father that pointed you towards Bletchley?
Yes, he believed that she may have been in Bletchley. We're not sure. I mean, and so we need to find out a bit more, really.
Did that spark your interest in coming here?
Oh, yes, and the film that's been done about Enigma and the Bletchley Circle, and I mean, it's all very fascinating. my two daughters, Rebecca and Victoria, they have a boy and a girl each, and of course they're all studying the wars at the moment because of the anniversaries coming up. So, I mean, for their sakes, we'd like to find out more.
You do know little snippets, don't you? Tell me about the family wedding.
Rebecca knows more about that. She's older.
I went down to South Wales to speak to her sister a couple of weeks ago, and she told me that Nana had found out that her brother had been killed in Italy before the family knew. The family knew he'd been injured, but they didn't actually know he'd died. And she had to go back to South Wales for a family wedding without being able to tell the family that he was actually dead. And they were all talking about, oh, well, you know, let's hope he gets sent home, let's hope he survives. And she was just sobbing at the wedding, and they couldn't understand why, because she knew and they didn't.
Can you imagine holding on to a secret like that?
Unbelievable. I couldn't have done that.
And knowing her, what does that make you think, your memories of her?
She was a very well-respected, how would you describe her, sort of kept herself to herself, didn't
yeah,
she?
Yeah, she was very loyal friend to people, yes, yes. Oh, we all loved her, you know.
It wouldn't have surprised me that she could have done that.
Yeah,
she
definitely.
Keep a secret, all right.
So much so that you now, it's too late and you don't know.
I know, it's so sad that we've got no gosser here to talk to anymore, but we'll try and find out what we can.
Find out a little bit more.
And get a lovely hairdo into the bargain today.
Absolutely. Oh, yes. This is a wonderful day.
We're going out for dinner later. We're looking all glam, won't we?
Yeah.
Lovely.
Enjoy.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Ferocious concentration was required to listen to enciphered enemy radio messages and write down the nonsensical jumbled letters accurately. Margaret Reardon, who was stationed at Douglas on the Isle of Man, said the intensity of this job took its toll. I met her when she was presented with her commemorative badge on her first ever visit to Bletchley Park.
It gives me great pleasure today to meet one of our visiting veterans who we only heard about 2 days ago. We reacted very quickly to this. It's Mrs. Margaret Reardon, who was Private Chapman in the ATS, Royal Signals, and she worked at the Y Service Training Centre at Douglas on the Isle of Man. And we're going to interview her at some stage in the future to get the full story. Very pleased to present you with this Bletchley Park Veterans Badge, which you can add to the two you've got on at the moment. There you are.
Thank you very much. Lovely. That is beautiful.
A certificate and your free pass to get you in.
Thank you very much.
And some more information from us.
Thank you.
And there's our magazine. And you'll be hearing from us, you know, regularly now with updates and good things. Thank you. Do you want to put that on now?
Yes, that would be lovely. Yeah, add it to my badges. Yes, that looks smart.
Oh. Another one for your collection. Have you only recently become aware that there was an official commemorative badge to be had?
I never knew there was. I was very proud of my service in the Air Forces and the ATS. I had a very nice time. I met my husband there.
What did he do?
He was in OCTU, going through officer training. And so
the
we
Essex
met.
Regiment,
the Essex
he?
Regiment. We met at the camp, because he was visiting the camp.
Very nice.
Yeah.
Well, look, let's go and find out a bit more.
I joined up in 1942. We were being conscripted into those sort of things, but I joined voluntarily. And I was sent to Glenparva Barracks in Leicester, and we were given intelligence tests. And I was asked if I'd like to do signals, which I said yes, it would be very nice. It was completely new to me, I didn't know anything about it. But we were made to listen to various sounds, and was this phrase of music the same as that phrase of music? Was that signal the same as that signal? So that's when I was sent off to the Isle of Man, to Palace Camp, which had just opened up. There were about 500 girls and 500 men up there, I think. Enormously large camp, which had been taken over from the internment camp. And so we were in various groups there, and we were given very concentrated lessons on whatever we were going to do. And then we started listening with earphones on 8 hours every day. And then we were given lectures in magnetism lessons, so we'd be able to do something with the set. It broke down, was just daft or anything. None of us had any ability to do that. And so that's what we were doing. And We had pads in front of us and we took it down.
And it was, of course, in ciphered, so it was...
It was in ciphered, we just were blocks of eight.
There's no sense of language that you're able to use within ciphered messages, because it is just random letters.
It was only sort of just letters coming down, that's right.
Whereabouts were you listening to, do you know?
We weren't told. We were just told to put what they called on a net. That was tuned into this, whatever it was. And we were told to listen to that. We listened for 8 hours every day. Yeah. Nearly drove us mad. Quite a few people broke down.
Too intense.
Yeah. There was a joke about one of the men who'd gone a bit mad. And he drew ducks on a blackboard and was feeding them. He had to be carried off. I think it really got into you, you know. You had to put your hand up if you wanted to go to the loo or if you wanted something to eat. And 8 hours going on all the time.
Fierce concentration. And you got to get it so accurately.
Yes, you had. Down. And then we used to have to do running hand when it came in the language as well. I could barely speak French, so I was trying to write it down.
So that was unenciphered, that was plain French?
Yes, that's plain French, yes, that's right. But we didn't have much of that. But then we were actually under training, so we weren't actually in the field actually doing it where it mattered. But we were taking the stuff down, which we understood was coming down to Bletchley.
Well, then it was real.
Yeah, and so after a bit, I think we all began to get a bit twitchy. I certainly did. And I began to have trouble with my hearing, probably tinnitus. And I started having allergies. We were being fed so much cheese. We were having vats and vats of cheese on toast. And I think I started getting itchy all over my skin. So I went to the doctor, and she told me I'd better not stay on that course. So I was sent to work in the chief instructor's office.
So how long were you listening before you were transferred?
About a year, I think.
That's a long time. Yes, it was. Something so intense.
Yes, it really got into me. And I think I began to sort of twitch and, you know, sort of not sleep and things like that. It was definitely upsetting me.
Did you see that in your colleagues? Did you see a lot of people finding it quite difficult?
Quite a lot of people did, yes. It was a tough job, and it was all the time, 8 hours, you know, going into your ears like that.
Fierce concentration as well, and I think most people would only really now expect to be able to keep that kind of level of concentration in quite short bursts. But you made of sterner stuff.
Yes, it was too much. The doctor signed me off the course. Some of the other girls I was with, they went on to finish, and some of the girls were sent overseas, and I got these allergies from the cheese, and so I was not fit for tropical service, which was rather funny, because when my husband and I were married, I went overseas for 26 years into the tropics, so I went and lived in Africa.
Well, and you were fine? No nasty cheese there?
No trouble. No.
What did you do after your worst service year? What was your next job?
I went into the office on the instructor's staff. My job was to go around with the register, make sure everybody was present, nobody had run away in the night, so, you know, that sort of thing.
Did that happen much? Did people run away?
And I think people did dodge off, and yes. Mm-hmm. And I had to go and get the post and bring it up. It was just a secretarial job, really. And then the camp packed up, because everybody was sent overseas by that time, so I was sent somewhere else. I went down to Shrewsbury and worked down there in the ATS still.
And so we came to the end of the war.
And yes, it's the end of the war then.
And then when did you meet your husband?
I met my husband up in the Isle of Man. I went to a dance one evening, and we had the Paul Jones, as it was called in those days, when the men went round in the outside circle, the women went round in the inside circle, and you danced with the person who's in front of you.
Oh, so it's quite random.
It was random, yes. It was a way of getting people to get mixed up. And I met this nice army lieutenant standing in front of me, so we danced, and then for some reason he managed to get round and get me again next time.
I bet he did that on purpose.
Yeah, he did it on purpose, yes, the whole of the evening. From then on, and he kept coming asking me to dance, and we started going out. We had to sneakily do it because I was in uniform, and as an officer he wasn't allowed to go out with a girl who was in the uniform.
Really?
No, a private anyway, strange. So I had to borrow some clothes from somebody I knew.
Pose as a civilian?
Yeah, pose as a civilian. And we were married 3 months later.
Oh, how wonderful.
Mm. And the marriage lasted many, many years until he died.
So after the war, did you focus on family life?
Yes, I went to Africa. He joined the colonial service. So we went.
So his career took you around.
Yes, it took me that round the world. I went 26 years in Africa after having been told I had to go.
Not fit for tropical service.
Not fit for tropical service. I know. Silly that was. No, we were all over East Africa. And eventually and to the Caribbean and to the Pacific. We were nearly 30-something, 40 years in the Pacific, around the world. And so he died at the age of 57 of a heart attack one day.
Just that completely out of the blue.
Yes, it was.
How sudden and dreadful. Oh. What was the social life like at the camp in the island?
Wonderful. Well, I spent my time dancing, actually. I was a great one for dancing. We had our own signals band, which was made up of many of the people from other bands, you know, from Henry Hall and all the people who were famous in those days. I used to spend every night dancing, I think every night, at the Palais de Danse or wherever there was a dance.
When you're young and you do a job that involves that kind of intense concentration, you need to burn off steam, don't you? Whereas, I think if you tried to do that job when you're in your 40s or 50s, you'd just want to go home and sit quietly afterwards,
oh, yes,
wouldn't you? It's a bit different, but you have that sort of pent-up energy.
Yes, the people in the Isle of Man were very kind because I went to Methodist Church there with a friend of mine who was in the camp with me, and the parson said any of the forces people who'd like to go home to supper, would they stand by the door? So my friend and I stood there, and these people came up to us and said, come home with us. So there were the Quirks, who were the bakers on the island, and they were very, very kind to us. And we went every Sunday there for a meal with them. We got to know their families, and we were able to have a bath there because we only had cold showers in the camp.
Oh, what luxury.
I know.
Well, that's kind of them.
Yes, it was kind.
I was comforts.
Very happy in the Isle of Man, very happy indeed. My daughter took me back there a few years ago. I hadn't been back since then.
Has it changed much?
No, just the same. We did actually go to the part of the palace camp where I'd been stationed, room at the very top, lovely view over the sea, and they had some photographs of the girls there. Not me, but the girls who were stationed there. And it was a very happy life. I loved being in the ATS.
And what about the secrecy that surrounded your work? You obviously couldn't talk about what you did. You'd signed the Official Secrets Act when you started.
Yes, that's right. 25 years we were told we were not allowed to do anything like that.
Were you given that time limit at the outset?
Yes, yes, oh, yes, we were.
So presumably once you married your husband and carried on with life after the war, you couldn't talk about it? You didn't tell him anything about it?
No.
Did he ever wonder? Did he ever ask?
No. I think I've written about it in my memoirs, that's all. But I didn't say anything about it except it was an interception work.
Did it change how you felt about it once you were able to talk about it? Was it different?
Not really. It was just a lovely period in my life. I was sorry that I hadn't been able to do it as properly as I was trained.
Well, I wonder how many people had the same experience you did in it.
I think probably a lot of people. It must have been very nerve-wracking. We were there at that table, two or three girls. Everybody had a set. And it went on for about 8 hours. And as I say, you had to put your hand up if you want to leave the room. And I think we were allowed sort of half an hour to go and get a meal. But it was all discipline, you know, sergeant.
Saluting. When you look back on it now, has it made much difference for you the way that it's now been recognised in recent years?
Yes, very nice. I'm very happy. I'm very pleased to hear this was all opening up here and yet people were interested in what we were doing. I mean, we thought we were winning the war.
You were.
Yes, we were, yes. When I went down to Shrewsbury, I went on the clerical staff. I was very proud of what I did down there because there was a St Dunstan's home just down the road and they asked us if we would go and take the boys out to the pub or to the pictures. We used to sit behind them, tell them what was going on, and then we'd take them out to the pub for a supper. That was a very proud bit of my ATS life as well. There were thousands of us in that camp learning. Long marches around the islands, and there must have been quite a sight of 1,000 people route marched around the island.
Well, the work itself was invisible, wasn't it? And unrecognised.
Yes, it was. Nobody knew what we were doing. We hadn't got any PT kit, so we had to run down the front in our khaki knickers.
How undignified.
I know it was, wasn't it? And the boys,
harsh.
The men in the camp were standing at the windows laughing at us. It was all right, I was very slim. I weighed 7 miles down, I was all right. And eventually they were shamed into giving some PT kit.
The small indignities you don't think of, aren't they?
No, I know. You can put that in.
Thank you. I will. Thanks to the staff, volunteers and veterans of Bletchley Park who took part in this podcast.
For more information, go to bletchleypark.org.uk or find us on iTunes. Also, follow us on Twitter, where we are at @BeeParkPodcast, and join our Facebook group. Thanks to Audioboo, who make this podcast possible. This podcast is produced for the Bletchley Park Trust by MC Fontaine. Thanks for listening, and we'll have more decrypts from the home of the Codebreakers next month.